Welcome, members and guests, to the June 19th program of the City Club of Eugene. Is there merit to merit selection? Should we stop electing judges? Thank you for joining us. I'm James Baldock, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Pacific University, Friends and Neighbors Realty Group, Friends and Neighbors Realty, low-key, no-pressure real estate sales and consulting, and KLCC. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 p.m. on Monday nights and for archiving the podcast on their site. I'd like to welcome two new members, Joshua Scove and Cindy Allen. Why don't we give them a round of applause? A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year, and today is our 39th program in our 2014-2015 program a year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. Today's program, Is There Merit to Merit Selection? Should We Stop Electing Judges? Is coordinated by Joel Corin.
Good afternoon. Picture yourself as the CEO of a large company that has just had a verdict against you in the millions of dollars, and it could break the company. The case is going through appeal. There's an election coming up on the Supreme Court of your state. Is electing the right justice for the appeal part of your plan for appeal? It could happen. It has happened. In a southern state, a similar thing happened, and the company tried to run a lawyer to become justice of the Supreme Court. If you care about this problem or want to learn about this problem, read John Grisham's book called The Appeal. Now, we have assembled today a panel that in my younger years would just scare the heck out of me. For 3 years in law school, I spent my time in the back of the room afraid that some law professor would call on me. When I practiced, I got the chance to argue appeals in the state Supreme Court and the state appellate courts, and I trembled for fear that they would ask me a question that surely I would not know. So today's program with a retired justice of the Supreme Court, a dean emeritus of a law school, and a law professor, I'm calm because I'm retired. Let me tell you about Justice Gillette. Justice Gillette went to Whitman College and Harvard Law School. He practiced in the Attorney General's office. He was an appeals court judge for 8 years. He was on the Oregon Supreme Court for 25 years. He teaches judges at the Reno Judicial College. The Judicial College is held in Reno, where judges all over the country go to learn how to become better judges. And I've met a number of lawyers and a number of judges during my career and since, and I can honestly say that Justice Gillette is the only person I've ever met who's admitted to the High Court of American Samoa. Dean Jim Huffman graduated from Montana State, went to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts, the University of Chicago Law School. He has been a distinguished teacher and served as the dean of Lewis and Clark. He is now the emeritus dean of Lewis and Clark, and he has written extensively on many topics, and including the topic of election of judges or alternate selection of judges. Our first question today, by the way, Justice Gillette had to run for judicial office, I think it was 6 times. Our first questioner today is Professor David Schumann from the University of Oregon Law School. He has a bachelor's degree from Stanford, a PhD in English literature from the University of Chicago, and a law degree from the University of Oregon. He taught at the University of Oregon undergraduate school and also has taught at the law school. In addition, Professor Schumann was on the appeals court in the state of Oregon and serves now part-time still doing some appeals. He had to run for office, and Professor Schumann has the interesting perspective of having run in a contested election for judicial office. So our first speaker today will be Justice Mick Gillette.
Thank you very much, Mr. Corn. I hope you all can hear me. Can you? Of course, the people in the back who are falling asleep are just as happy that they can't hear me. But I'll try to ignore that, at least for the moment. Thanks for asking me to be here. This topic is one that judges sometimes think they're the only ones who care about. The vast majority of the public doesn't seem interested most of the time. I think the public interest was whipped up a little bit 6 years ago when the Caperton case got to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's the case that Mr. Corn was talking about, in which the owner of a coal mining company literally bought himself a seat on the West Virginia Supreme Court, and that person happened to cast the deciding vote in saving the company $50 million. It therefore seemed worthwhile that the owner of the company had spent $3 million on the judicial election. Now, if $3 million seems like a bunch, and I'll have to agree that it is, let me just give you a statistic and probably the only one that I'll stick you with this afternoon. Between 1990 and 2000, records show that approximately $83 million were spent on judicial elections in the United States. Now, $83 million is a lot of money. It's more than Dean Huffman makes in a month. But nonetheless, that was the figure then. But between 2000 and 2009, which includes the period of time when the judge was elected for the Caperton case, the figure rose from $83 million to $206 million. And we don't know what it is now, except you can be confident that the figure is slightly higher or greatly higher than it was then. Money buys positions when people run for office. And so those who have the money and who see some reason to care about who is making judicial decisions are prepared to spend that money on judicial elections. Now, when you look at Oregon's system, you might say, well, there isn't much reason to be concerned here in Oregon. The Oregon system has appointments to vacant positions by the governor, or if a position vacancy arises at the end of a term, parties can simply run for that position. The election is nonpartisan. The election may or may not be contested, but more commonly is not than is contested. And the position is occupied for 6 years, at which time the judge has to run again in a nonpartisan election. What's not to like? Well, let's take a few things. For instance, the governor's appointment power. I don't know if you've noticed, but we elect governors by party in this state. Now, I recognize that at the moment there is only one party in the state, but nonetheless, we elect a governor by party. And the governor, therefore, is a spokesperson for the party in some sense when the governor makes judicial appointments. Is political influence involved in such a process? It has to be. That doesn't mean it's bad, but it has to be. The governor, after all, has to pay attention to the concerns and interests of those who help get him elected. That's just fair. And so the governor is going to consider those points. Is the governor going to let them be decisive? I doubt it. But nonetheless, the governor is going to consider them. Second, do governors make bad choices? Oh, yeah. But not often, and not in Oregon very often. I've had the privilege now of serving as a judge for a third of a century, watching judges before then and watching judges later. And I can tell you honestly and without any need to protect my line of work that I met very few judges, saw very few judges, saw the work of very few judges that was anything other than competent, and most of them seemed to me to be far more than just competent. They seemed to me to be skilled professionals who had been appropriately selected, even if there were other people the governor could have chosen who would have been equally skillful. But nonetheless, governors can, and our governors occasionally have, made just plain bad appointments. By the way, the bad part of the appointment almost always turns out to be revealed after the governor makes the appointment. You know, well, you know, I didn't know that my appointee had three people locked up in his basement and had them there for years. That was news. I probably wouldn't have appointed him under those circumstances. And the other consideration with respect to the governor's appointment is the fact that in Oregon we do not use an advise and consent function in the Senate. The governor's appointment power is his power, period. I say his, and now Kate will come into the room and hit me over the head with something, is the governor's power his or hers, period. And under those circumstances, without a checks and balance, at least in review by the Senate, we don't have the same kind of protections that the U.S. Supreme Court appointments have. If you happen to think that the procedures in the Senate these days on advice and consent are anything other than a zoo. But I'm confident that if we did that, and if we did the same thing in Oregon, it would not be a zoo. Oregon's elected representatives and senators who have to actually go back and face their home constituents probably would behave better. But that's conjecture. Now, secondly, okay, if let's say we can get past the gubernatorial appointment thing, in part because somebody's got to do it. You know, in this sense, the governor is doing no more than exercising the power that normally resides with the chief executive in virtually any place in the known world. Somebody has to have the power, the authority, and the obligation to appoint people to vacant positions. So let's suppose we get past that. Then we get to the point of, well, yeah, but this is done by election. Elections? What are the elections about? Well, first of all, they're contested in Oregon, or they may be. Is that good or bad? And here you have to ask yourself, well, okay, I don't remember the last time I voted in a contested judicial election, but what would I want to know if I were going to vote for a judge, a trial judge or a court of appeals judge or a Supreme Court judge? Well, for starters, I suppose I'd want to know something about what the job involves. And outside of watching Judge Judy on TV, most of us have very little information as to what it is judges are doing. And certainly there's virtually no information with respect to what a court of appeals judge or what a Supreme Court justice does. So you start with an information deficit with respect to elections. You're being asked to vote for somebody who's going to be in office for 6 years and who's going to be performing what appears to be a pretty important function. And you don't know very much about what the task really involves. And then secondly, the question becomes, okay, even if I understand the task and I'm confronted with two or more candidates for a particular open position, how am I supposed to judge between them? What do I know about these people, all of whom are lawyers? What do I know about these people that will assist me in figuring out which one of them, if any, deserves my vote? Now, you may have criteria in mind which apply to all elections of any kind, which will make it easier. For example, you may feel that if a professor from the University of Oregon is running for something, he's not Marcus Mariota, but he's the next best thing, you'll certainly vote for that person. Judge Schumann always got my vote on that basis alone. But if you don't have pre-existing criteria into which one or another of the candidates fit, what are you going to do? Hopefully you haven't spent most of your adult life working with lawyers. That would be a disaster. So you tend not to know very much about the law and about what judges do. Hopefully also you know a lawyer or two whose judgments you trust, and you can at least ask them what they think so that you can begin to gather information. But again, you're starting with an information deficit with respect to whom to choose. And then finally, there's the question, just with respect to the election, there's the question of the meaning of the nonpartisan piece of it. People don't run by party. That's a thing for us in Oregon. We get rid of partisanship wherever we can, at least superficially. And the most superficial way of all is to say this is a nonpartisan election. You cannot run supported by a particular party. Well, that's not quite right. You can run supported by a party. You just can't seek the party's support. The U.S. Supreme Court dealt with that about 20 years ago in a case out of Minnesota. But nonetheless, you don't run as a Democrat or a Republican or a Green Party member or a Tea Party member or anything else. So, again, you don't have the handy way of dividing people up between the group you favor and the group you don't, or as I once made the terrible mistake of asking Judge Schumann when he was a lawyer, differentiating the wheat from the chaff. And at least I can get a smile out of David because he must remember the question and the answer. I've made an idiot of myself many times in my life, but never more than with that question, and boy, did he nail me. Anyway, I'll get even with you someday, David, but I'm not sure how. So what are you being asked to do? You're being asked to vote for what is apparently a very important job based upon an information deficit which is hard to cure. You don't really know very much and can't gain a whole ton of information with respect to what it is this person is going to be doing to figure out whom to vote for. But nonetheless, we're going to elect them. We're not going to just have them appointed for life or some other really terrible thing about a terrible approach like that. And then finally, with respect to this process, and I think I've identified it obliquely by discussing what it is you don't know, what are the two things that we're really worried about more than anything else? We do at least know we want judges to be fair, to treat everybody equally. We want to know that if we have to go to court, that the playing field is level. And because we want to know that, we want to know who's behind this particular candidate or that particular candidate. Who is supporting this candidate or that candidate? And that gets us back to the two things that seem to me to be really important in all of these questions, and that is, first of all, influence. Who has influence with respect to a particular person by virtue of blood, marriage, shared profession, or any one of 100 other things that you can imagine? And most important of all, because it is the mother's milk of politics, money. We want to know where the money is coming from. And Oregon has relatively good reporting laws with respect to where the money comes from, but unless you do a lot of research about who those people are who are providing the money, you still have an information deficit with respect to what it means that Fred donated $100,000 to X's campaign and Bill donated $150,000 to Y's campaign. We just know that when the money gets to be that serious, there's probably something wrong. It ought not to matter that much to anybody, to be truthful about it. It ought not to matter that much to anybody that they're going to spend that kind of money, and we'd like to know what it is these people think they're buying for it. Now, in the 3 or 4 minutes I've got left, let me tell you that every state has faced this same question, and all 50 states in the District of Columbia have solved it differently. But it's possible to offer a few generalities. For one, election is the primary means of selecting judges in 21 states. Which may seem like it's less than half, but the truth is that in another 18 or so states, judges are selected by an appointment system, serve for a while, and then stand for retention. That's not a contested race when they stand for retention. The question on the ballot is, shall Judge Huffman be retained? And so those are also elections, and they matter in this respect very much. When you're running alone on a ballot, and the question is, shall you be retained or not? If it's a lot easier to get people to vote against you than for you. Most of the time, and studies have shown this now for about 70 or 80 years in politics, a no vote is passionate. A yes vote is eh. And because no votes are passionate, it's very important to recognize that when an individual stands for election naked and alone, shall Judge X be retained, the judge is an easy target for campaigns that want to label the judge as something soft on crime, soft on business, soft in the head, something. Scurrilous attacks, which the judge is going to have a hard time answering. And so when you add the two, it turns out there are roughly 38 or 39 different jurisdictions in which judges are elected in one way or another, either initially or after a period of time when the question of retention arises. And if we don't like politics and we don't like money, rest assured that the retention elections are just as vulnerable to the expenditure of money, if not more so, than contested elections. And indeed, the one value of a contested election is at least if a lot of money is being spent against you, you can say, you really want to elect her instead of me? And you can point to whatever defects in character and personality the other candidate may have. So at least it has that value, if none other. Now, all I've done, of course, so far is just simply criticize what's done. And I haven't offered a solution. And the solution seems to me to be something that people have to settle after they first recognize all the things that are wrong with the systems that are in use. And that takes a discussion all by itself. Common Cause has worked on this for a long time. They keep proposing bills which the legislature doesn't even consider, much less send to the people. But the fact is that you ought to care about this. because today or tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, a court which has jurisdiction over you and your life is going to make a decision which alters your life in a profound way. And if you voted and you didn't vote for the person who's on the court, or worse yet, you voted for them and were misinformed, you probably deserve what happens to you. Thanks.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be in Eugene. I had the pleasure many, many years ago of teaching for a semester at the University of Oregon Law School, which I enjoyed a lot. It was great being in a real university town. Not that I don't also like living in Portland. I think in a democracy such as we live in, voters have to have some kind of a role in the selection of judges. What should that role be? Well, I think Justice Gillette has suggested some good questions that we might think about and some factors we might take into account in deciding what the role of the voters should be in the selection of judges. Let me first make a comment about the Oregon system, which was implicit in some of what Justice Gillette said. But we do purport to have an elective system, but as he pointed out, we very seldom actually have competitive contested elections. Now, Judge Schumann will say that they do happen now and then, and he had the pleasure of participating in one contested election, at least, that I'm aware of. But let me just give you a few numbers, and these are a little outdated because I wrote an article back in 2003 in the Willamette Law Review on the subject of judicial selection in Oregon. They did a symposium on it, and if you're interested in this topic, it's a good resource if you want to look at some varying views about the subject. But here are the numbers. Of the 8 new Supreme Court justices appointed between 1983 and 2003, eight were appointed and 4 were elected. Of the Court of Appeals judges, 14 were appointed and 2 were elected. Of the 33 Supreme Court elections in that period, 22 were uncontested. And in the Court of Appeals elections, there were 47, 41 were uncontested. So in the vast majority of cases, we're not electing our judges in the sense that we have two candidates and we're choosing between them. I'm not saying that's good or bad, but I'm saying we ought to be realistic about the way our system actually works. Now, I think there is a strong case to be made for the election of judges, or at least the participation of voters in some significant way in the process of judicial selection. The judiciary, after all, is just one of 3 branches of our government. We would never question that we should have a role in electing the members of the legislature or the executive, nor I think should we question that there should be some significant role for voters in deciding who are going to serve in the 3rd branch of government. I think part of the reason we're concerned about how we select judges is that one of our objectives is to have an independent judiciary, that is, one that is independent from the legislature and independent from the executive. But I don't think we want the judiciary entirely independent from the people, because they are, in a very real way, representatives performing an essential function of our government. Now, in this article I wrote now, I guess it's 13 years ago, I suggested a little thought experiment that went like this. Imagine that our judicial selection process is as follows. We have a commission, a national commission, consisting of the chief justices of all 50 Supreme Courts or high courts in all the 50 states. And when we're selecting judicial judges for the state of Oregon, we will recuse the Oregon Supreme Court Chief Justice, just to make sure that there's no bias there. So we'd have 49 justices, Chief Justices from all the other courts in the United States deciding who would be judges in Oregon. To which you must say, that's ridiculous. Well, it is ridiculous. Or let's say we have a rule that says we'll select judges to make sure there's no bias, to make sure they're independent. We'll select judges who have no connection to Oregon. They can be residents of some other state, never been to Oregon. Ridiculous, again, you'd say, of course. Well, why is it ridiculous? Because these people are people who represent us. We want Oregonians. We want people who understand the state in which they're going to be working. So I think that little thought experiment says, yeah, there's clearly a role we want to play. We're not looking for only independence in our judges. Well, it's often said that we have to get the politics out of judging, and Justice Gillette, Judge Schumann, they would speak from experience. I speak, as all academics do, from no experience on anything. But if we want to get the politics out of the judicial selection process or out of judicial decision making, I think we're fooling ourselves. We're never going to get politics out of any aspect of government. Government is, after all, politics. You know, you often hear people saying, if we could only get the politics out of the decisions that are being made in Congress or in Salem, it's absurd. That we do these decisions publicly because we want to do them publicly, which means politically. And I don't think the judiciary is any different. It's different in the role that it plays, but I think it's naive to think that we can actually get politics entirely out of judging. In the legal academy, we all learned about what were called the legal realists, and these were people writing back in the 1920s and 1930s who said that you got to be realistic here. Judges have families, they have backgrounds, they grew up in different places, and that inevitably influences them. And that's a reality, including their politics. Most people who get appointed to the judiciary have had some engagement in politics before, or certainly taken an interest in public issues. They bring that with them. As hard as they may try, it can't, I don't believe, be left entirely behind. So the challenge really is to figure out what is the proper role for the electorate, for the political input into the judicial selection process. Now, if you look at the way it happens in Oregon, you might say, well, why even worry about this? Because the voters obviously don't care. The undervote on judicial elections is immense. The undervote being how many people don't vote. They vote in the governor's election, they vote in the Secretary of State election, then they get to the judges and they just skip over that and don't bother to vote, even in many cases when it's a contested election, although they're more likely to if it's contested. So we might ask, why don't they vote? Well, to me the more interesting question is, why do those who do vote in judicial elections? And I would suggest to you it's because they have some reason to believe that one candidate or the other is going to see the world the way they see it. I think that's why we vote for just about everybody, is their worldview, their view on a very particular issue that we are aware of, but it's something that connects to their personal values. And I think that's unavoidable. That's inevitable. That's just the way it is, I think, if we're realistic about the world we live in. Well, what are the alternatives if we were to decide that judicial election or selection of judges by election is not the right path? What are the alternatives? And the title of the program suggests the usual alternative is something described as merit selection. Merit selection comes in a lot of different forms. There's something called the Missouri Plan that goes way back, I think, to the 1950s or so, and many states have adopted versions of that. And that's merit selection, suggesting that selecting judges by election is not on merit. Well, it's just a different kinds of merit, I suppose. Certainly the people who voted for Justice Gillette when he was running, or for Judge Schumann when he was running, thought they were voting on the merits, particularly in David's contested election. I think the sides that developed in that race believed that one or the other of the candidates merited the position, was better suited to fill the job. But what merit selection often means is some kind of a panel of people who have some kind of special expertise who are going to recommend at least a slate of judges. Often it's a slate of judges to be appointed then by the governor. And I think there are some reasons to be, I think these merit selection systems are valuable and can be effective, but they're not a perfect solution. Often, I think, merit selection panels can become captured in the sense that there are groups who are, take a particular interest in judicial elections who've get themselves in a position to actually have influence or to actually occupy the positions on the merit selection. And often it can be members of the bar. I think in merit selection systems, it's the legal profession that tends to dominate the process. And I'm not sure that is necessarily always in the interests of the electorate generally. And even more narrowly, it's possible that certain segments of the bar, particular areas of practice who have a particular interest in how the court system who the membership of the courts are can effectively capture the process and have, undue influence. So I think one needs to be cautious of that. I think that the system that we now have in Oregon is in many ways a sort of a merit selection system. The governors do it however they want, but most of them have had a panel of people who then recommend a slate of potential nominees. And so we may be doing it, we may in Oregon have a very mixed system right now where some kind of assessment of merit in the sense of legal background and legal competence and judicial temperament and the other factors that people think are important weigh in, as well as the elective process. In this piece I wrote for the Willamette Law Review several years back, I actually suggested a very concrete proposal, which, like most things that academics propose, sank without a trace. But it was, at the heart of it, was something that we really haven't talked about, and which to me is a factor to which we ought to pay more attention, and that is the nature of the tenure of whoever is selected. It's important who we select, and I agree with Justice Gillette. I think the judges that I know in this state, the judges I know in the federal system, are the vast majority are excellent judges who do their very best to be independent and objective and not to allow their background to overwhelm their decisions on the court that they happen to sit on. But the place where influence, it seems to me, is likely to have an impact is not just at the election process, but at the re-election process or at the reappointment process. In a merit system, you appoint somebody for, say, 6 years. That position is almost always renewable. What does a judge do to position him or herself best to be renewed? I think that is where influence can have a significant effect. So one of the things that I think we ought to think about is longer tenure for judges, whether elected or appointed, and in fact, a longer tenure with no possibility of renewal. Now, that's a problem for people in the legal profession, because if a young person gets appointed to a 6-year term and can't be renewed, they're much less likely to take that step because it pulls them out of their career and they can't proceed. But if it's a long term, 12, 15 years, or in the federal system, a life term. I know there's a lot of people who object to life tenure in the federal system, but I think it's one of the keys to the success of the federal system because it removes any need to be responsive to the demands of political interests in order to retain the position. And so I think that's a piece of it that we ought to look at. I guess my bottom line is that politics will inevitably play a role, and our challenge is to figure out what that role should be. At the end of the day, what we ought to be thinking about is how do we assure that there's public confidence in the courts. I think people who understand and know the judges have confidence in the courts, but does the public have confidence in the courts? And I think the system of selection that we use and the system of retention is one that ought to inspire confidence in the general population, because that is what really is most important at the end of the day. Thanks.
It's a pleasure to be able to have this opportunity to ask the first question. And this is a question that's actually directed to both of the panelists. Study after study shows that despite the fact that 80% of the voters don't vote in judicial elections. The undervote is always the winner, I suppose, if you're toting up votes. At the same time, 80% of the voters oppose giving up the right to vote for judicial office holders, for judges. So we've had these discussions for a very long time about whether or not we should change the system of judicial selection in Oregon, but underlying all those discussions, I think, is this question. Is there any possibility, is there any realistic political possibility that the people of Oregon would voluntarily give up the vote in judicial elections? As you know, to change the current system of selection would require a constitutional amendment. Constitutional amendment has to be voted on by the people. So is it a realistic political possibility to move to a merit system or any other kind of system?
Well, that, of course, is a hugely important question, and I had no idea what David was going to ask, but I hoped somebody would. I used to say in speeches around the state that we in Oregon believe in voting for everybody from the dog catcher on up, and we are very much a participatory democracy in that sense. We really like to vote on everything. In fact, as I recall, there's a provision in the Oregon Constitution, moribund, but you can still find it, that provides that the legislature may direct that the state printer be elected. Now, that's a little less silly than it seems, because the cost of state printing was an enormous expenditure for a government that didn't have a lot of tax income. But nonetheless, it describes an attitude, and I don't think we've changed a whole bunch since then. It may very well be that the only time we would get a serious consideration of adopting, just to pick something, a system that would provide for life tenure, that would take the vote away from the people, the only way we would get that would be for some awful scandal to occur with respect to judges who presently were sitting, a situation bad enough so that people would be persuaded that they didn't want to go through that again. I like to think the people of Oregon are more rational than that, and I've sort of committed my life to assuming that they can have a tax of rationality, but it does seem to me that it's a challenge, to put it mildly.
Well, I would agree. I think the politics of getting it done in this state, it would be very difficult, but it has happened in several other states. And so it would be interesting to know what the circumstances were, how those campaigns to make that change was accomplished, whether there were similarities or differences with the state of Oregon. But it's an interesting set of statistics, David, that we have 80% undervote, and yet 80% who don't want to give up the vote. Although I assume that the voting in contested elections is considerably higher, but I think there's still a significant undervote in those elections as well. And it may be partly go to a point that Justice Gillette made, which is that the voters recognize that they don't know what they feel like they should know in order to vote, and so they don't vote, which is sort of an informed non-vote. But I do agree. Maybe the point of David's question is that this is a sort of a pointless conversation, because the reality is we'll never see the system change. But I still think it's a useful conversation. I think the chances of it changing are pretty slim.
Okay, thank you. Today's topic is there merit to merit selection? Should we stop electing judges? Our speakers are the retired Justice W. Michael Gillette and James Huffman, Dean Emeritus, Lewis and Clark Law School. We'll break now for a few minutes and then return with members' questions.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, KMPQ Roseburg. We're on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet. This is KLCC, NPR for Oregonians.
Welcome back to the June 19th City Club program. Is there merit to merit selection? Should we stop electing judges? Our guest speakers are retired Justice W. Michael Gillette and James Huffman. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each.
Randy Prince, City Club member. Thank you for your presentation on this. A question I've always wondered when I cast my ballot, how should I know? We did hear some illusions, problems with the merit system. I appreciated that. But before that, the problems in our election system is the money and the lack of information. And since it was pointed out that maybe there's a problem getting people to abandon election, would it be possible to have a better election, one without money? Sort of the publicly funded formula, where the campaigning is based on things like the voter's pamphlet, expanded information without a lot of campaign dollars being raised, and maybe more candidates and more information about what we're actually voting for. Would it be possible to do that just for the judicial elections to kind of showcase that alternative and solve this problem?
Well, I suppose I should say that I'm less concerned about money in elections than I suspect most people in the audience are. I think whatever regulations we put in place, people will find ways around them. That's certainly what's happened so far in campaign finance reform. But let me suggest that there is a model, although a very modest model, of an alternative way to assess a public issue. We have in Oregon something that probably none of you have heard of called the Citizens Initiative Review Commission, on which I sit. Our role is to, as a commission, is to organize a set of reviews of citizen initiatives, which then spend almost an entire week of citizens from all over the state, and they review whatever the initiative is, and then they write statements that go in the voter's pamphlet. So you've probably seen those statements in the voter's pamphlet. It's too early to tell how effective this has been, but it's a model that might be applied to judges. You could have a similar sort of panel of people assembled to assess, particularly in contested elections, the merits of opposing judges, and maybe that would reduce the politics of it. I would also say that the biggest problem with the Citizens Initiative Review Commission is that it gets zero funding from the state of Oregon. And so these panels that are assembled have to be funded by fundraising, not by the commission members, fortunately, but by other groups who are interested in making it work. But it's an alternative sort of approach.
This is Michael Gillette. Funding from public sources for judicial campaigns seems like a good idea, but the difficulty lies in the fact that the campaigns we worry about are the ones in which a single issue person, party, or group wishes to influence the election, and they don't have to do it by contributing to the judge's campaign. They can do it by waging an independent campaign on which they can spend as much money as they wish. And so it seems to me that it's fine usually, but it's fine in situations in which we probably needn't care as much anyway. I'm concerned about the single issue people like the that led to the Caperton case. My company doesn't want to pay a $50 million penalty, and under those circumstances, it can be financed independently, and at least the way I read the tea leaves from the U.S. Supreme Court, there's nothing to be done about that. And so it's fine, but I'm not really sure that it addresses the problem. And while I think Jim is right when he says that perhaps it's easy to overstate the concern about money, when money is in play, it's the only concern.
Susan Conley, City Club member. Thank you both so much for coming today. I feel like we have a quasi-merit-based selection process, unless things have changed since I practiced law. Here in Eugene, we had a bar poll, and the bar poll went out to all the attorneys. The attorneys knew who the good guys were and the not-so-good guys. They knew who was fair, who was balanced, who had experience in court, and who maybe had the temperament to be a good judge. And it was our feeling that when those names that came out tops in the bar poll were forwarded to the governor, that the governor then had a good slate of people to choose from. So perhaps they don't do that anymore, and I don't know about it, but could you comment on the bar poll, please?
This is Michael Gillette. Bar polls are valuable, but only to the extent that the person who has the appointment authority will pay attention to them. Generally speaking, governors have been pretty good about that, both with respect to statewide elections and also with respect to local circuit court matters. But there was at least one governor I know who didn't want to hear from anybody else and said so. And therefore, the bar poll was simply an exercise that the candidate could use in his or her voter's pamphlet in running against the person that the governor decided to appoint. But it wasn't going to particularly help out. All you need is a governor with an open mind who's prepared to look at that information in addition to whatever else the governor considers in making an appointment. To that extent, it is a quasi-merit system in part. And anything that can be done along those lines where people who have some reason to know the capacities of the individual candidates can speak to those issues.
Jim Huffman, I agree with what Justice Gillette says. I think it's your point is a good one, and I think perhaps the evidence of it is that we have a pretty high-quality judiciary in the state, in my opinion. Maybe there's not as big a problem as we may be imagining here.
Hi, thank you both for coming. I'm Marlene Nessery, City Club member. And my question is two-part. One's really easy, and it is, must all judges be lawyers? And the next one is, I'm concerned about your comments that people don't know how judges work, and that's, I think, true. So let's say that it's take your daughter to work day and you're going to tell them how you work as a judge, and or you're facing a City Club room full of students who are interested in how judges do their work. So I've had a little bit of experience when we were negotiating to have Sandra Day O'Connor come here about what we could ask and what we could not ask. So let's imagine that we get a sitting Supreme Court judge to come and talk to us. Could they tell us how they make their decisions? Could they tell us how they do their research? Could they tell us how their decision-making has changed over time, moving from lower courts to the Supreme Court? I mean, we know that when you get into the thick of things, reality can shape in different ways. But what are the values and the habits of mind and the temperament that drive the judicial work?
We've both decided to defer to the other person. This is Michael Gillette. First of all, the answer is in the state system, yes, judges have to be lawyers. Doesn't have to be done that way, and in other states it isn't. And judges who are justices of the peace in Oregon do not have to be lawyers, but in the state system they do. With respect to a judge's way of thinking about problems, the way a judge goes at it, as long as the judge is not being asked about or is not communicating how that judge is presently deciding or plans to decide or decided a specific case, then any other question seems to me to be entirely proper. I'm not real surprised that Justice O'Connor would have thought otherwise, but nonetheless, as far as I'm concerned, people are entitled to know and to become dismayed about the way my mental processes work. I'm prepared to risk that, and even when I was a sitting judge, I would discuss that in groups with respect to this is how I go about it, this is what I read, this is what I think about, these are the values in general that I try to first identify and then apply. There's nothing secret, or difficult to understand about that, it seems to me, and I was perfectly happy to do it. And I think judges ought to be forthcoming about that. But we really cannot discuss the way in which we're solving a particular problem at present or even explain the way we solved a particular problem in the past, because our solution for the problem in the past is to be found in the opinion we wrote, and that's the beginning and the end of the public discussion that we are entitled to offer.
This is Jim Huffman. I was reminding Justice Gillette that probably 35 years ago, he put on a white wig and went to my daughter's class at Riverdale grade school and played the role of the judge in a mock proceeding. I think those kinds of exposures are invaluable to young people to get them to understand and appreciate and be interested in our system. So your question gives me the opportunity to get on one of my hobby horses, which is the inadequacy of civics education in our society generally. I think there's an immense amount that our young people just do not know, and don't really have a good opportunity to learn, and I don't have a solution to how to get there. But I guess we could send Justice Gillette around to all the schools in WIG.
David Fedanke, City Club member. And my question for both of you, and Professor Huffman may have already answered this in a previous question, but I want to ask it in a different way. If you could wave your magic wand and change the Oregon Constitution to a different process of selecting and retaining judges, what would that look like?
Well, I would refer you to my Willamette Law Review article, in which I make a five-point explanation of what we need to do, which is basically my idea would be that you have a commission that selects, that recommends judges to the governor or potential judges to the governor, and that it be a selection committee that is as politically balanced as you can achieve, and that the one change from the way we do it now would, I think that confirmation in the legislature by the Senate or perhaps by the House, which is probably, they're both, I guess, equally representative of the people under new apportionment standards. I guess they're not new apportionment standards, they're 50 years old, but I think that confirmation process would be a good adaptation of the existing system because it would get the people involved. And then, as I said earlier, I think I would try to make the tenure longer and non-renewable so that judges didn't have any incentives to decide cases with the anticipation of their being reappointed.
This is Michael Gillette. David's nice to see you again. I've come very close to Dean Huffman's position with respect to this. I agree with respect to as politically balanced as possible an evaluation or merit system committee. I would require the governor to make the governor's appointment from the list submitted by that committee. I would not let the governor go off the reservation. Now, you said I get to wave a magic wand, so I'm doing it. I believe, too, that Senate confirmation is proper, which I've opposed in Oregon in general because it seemed to me for a part-time legislature it didn't make as much sense as it did for the federal government. But we're coming closer and closer to a full-time legislature, so that seems fine to me, too. And here's the one place where we part, and it's actually only a matter of degree rather than kind. For people who get through that process, I would give them life tenure for this reason. It seems to me that even if you have a fairly long period of time, 20 years, for example, I went on the bench at age 35, and that's older than some people go on the bench. But that would have meant that by age 55, I was suddenly out on the street with none of the contacts or any basis for starting up a law practice after all that time. Now, as it happens, in my case, I left the bench after 33 years and immediately went to work with a large law firm. But that's not the usual experience, and I only did it because I just felt like keeping my hand in. I think if someone is willing to give up the incentives of private practice and the financial rewards that may come with it, that they deserve to be assured that they've got work to do in the public interest for the balance of their professional lives. And so I would prefer the system that's used in Rhode Island, which is the only place that does it exactly as I'm describing. And second to that, the system that's used in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, which gives judges tenure till the age of 70, at which time they have to leave the bench. And I only resent that because I'm over 70 and I'm still alive.
My name is Ruth Miller. I've been a member since 1990 of the City Club. And our question is back to really how things are functioning now. What are the restraints on judges campaigning for re-election or for election or re-election? I have a second one, and if you have time, it's what are the remedies for removing a judge if citizens do not like the judge's decisions?
Well, I should defer to you on the restraints on judges because you've been restrained, and I'm not sure. I mean, I don't mean that you're a restrained individual. I mean that you've had to exercise under whatever those restraints are. So.
I suppose. This is Michael Gillette. With respect to the restraints on judges, we are restricted in the manner in which we can seek funds for our campaign. We cannot personally solicit the funds. They have to be solicited, pardon me, for us by a campaign. And we can't, of course, promise to do anything in particular with respect to any particular case. There are obvious limitations there. Although there's a nice question as to whether after Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, even that's true. But in any event, the campaign restrictions, personal campaign restrictions, were just affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called You versus the State Bar of Florida. So I'm glad to say at least that part of Oregon's system works. The way it works in practice is you ask a number of people to run a campaign for you, and then you pay as much attention as appears appropriate. In my case, I told my campaign treasurers I don't want to know anybody who's contributed to my campaign, much less how much. And so I have no idea to this day who, maybe if anybody, contributed to my six campaigns. I know they did because we had money to give to another campaign when I was finished. But I just stayed absolutely away from it because that seemed to me to be most consistent with the spirit of the rules that applied. And I'll let you talk about what are we going to do about judges we think are nitwits. I understood that to be the other question.
This is Jim Huffman. Well, under the existing system, I think our remedy is not to reelect them. But I think experience suggests that has probably happened occasionally in the state of Oregon, but I'm not aware of when it's happened. At the federal level, of course, there is the possibility of impeachment of judges, as there is of the president. That's happened a few times, not very many times. But I think part of the idea of an elective system, short of one that has life tenure, is that the way you get rid of judges, the way you get rid of any elected official, is you don't reelect them.
Hello, thank you both for being here and for presenting your perspectives. My name is Juan Carlos Valle. I'm a City Club member and also serve on the board. So it seems to me there's two perspectives that has been presented to you and to those who are, in fact, have stood for election. One is understanding what you do and helping us understand what you do. And the second one is accountability. So those are the two points that I think they're important to capture. Here's my question. Say that we voters decide not to continue with the process that we have in electing some of you. Would you be supportive of the process we have in place, such as the process we have for the governor? For the governor, we elect him for no more than 2 terms, and he or she has to stand out for 1 term, and then could come back. Is that something you will recommend and something you will support?
Well, this is Jim Huffman. I think that the practical difficulty with that is that, as Justice Gillette suggested, no one at the age of 35 will probably abandon a good career to become a judge with the prospect of serving only 8 years or even 12 years, assuming they got reelected for a second term. So to me, that's the practical problem. And I would say that, in fact, in my Willamette Law Review article, my first preference is for life tenure, so we're in full agreement on that. I think I just view that as an unlikely political outcome, but I think it would be a better outcome.
I think it's terribly important that you not penalize people for wanting to perform public service. And if you create a regime in which, and while they are still perfectly capable of leading useful lives in a lot of different ways, you remove them from the public service that they wanted so much to perform and say, you're on your own, kid, but the one thing you can't do is do anything more in public service for a period of time or forever, that's the wrong message. That asks for more sacrifice than I'm willing to ask of most people. Idiots like me might do it, but most people have better sense.
Okay, thank you. Retired Justice Michael Gillette and James Huffman for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program. Is there merit to merit selection? Should we stop electing judges? And thanks again to our sponsors, Pacific University, Friends and Neighbors Realty Group, and KLCC. We meet again on June 26th at the Downtown Athletic Club for the Finances, Challenges, and Future of Intercollegiate Athletics with guest speakers Professor William Harbour, Department of Economics at the University of Oregon, and Professor Emeritus Dennis Howard, Marketing, Lundquist College of Business, University of Oregon. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thank you very much. Let's have a round of applause for our guests.